Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does a dispute about foolishness have to do with him? If right and wrong are clear to all, who was ever more senseless than this man? Because he never weighed the justice of the case, nor appealed to the universal law of Hellas? For when Agamemnon breathed his last, struck on his head by my daughter, a most foul deed which I will never defend, he should have brought a charge against his mother and inflicted a holy penalty for bloodshed, banishing her from his house. Thus he would have gained moderation instead of calamity, keeping strictly to the law and showing his piety as well. As it is, he has come into the same fate as his mother. For though he had just cause for thinking her a wicked woman, he has become more wicked by murdering her. I will ask you, Menelaus, just one question. If a man's wedded wife should kill him, and his son, in turn, will kill his mother in revenge, next to the Avenger's son, to expiate this murder, will commit another. Where will the chain of horrors end? Our forefathers settled these matters the right way. They forbade anyone with blood upon his hands to appear in their sight or cross their path, but they purified him by exile. They did not kill him in revenge. Otherwise, someone, by taking the pollution last upon his hands, is always going to be liable to have his own blood shed. Now, I hate wicked women, especially my daughter who killed her husband. Helen, too, your own wife, I will never commend, nor would I even speak to her. And I do not envy you a voyage to Troy for a worthless woman. But the law I will defend with all my might to put an end to this brutal spirit of murder, which is always the ruin of countries and cities alike. Oh, hi, hello. Lovely to have you here. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby, and I am Liv. She who just wants to talk about Euripides forever, but knows you all want some variety. So she promises to mix it up after this series, maybe. We'll see. Gods, I love Euripides, because he is perfect. We are back again with more of Euripides' Orestes, one of the most unique takes on the story of that cursed House of Atreus, the murders of Agamemnon and then Clytemnestra after the Trojan War. Just like last week, that long quote at the top, which was a speech that we will get to, whew, and that I just couldn't help myself from reading, is a translation by Coleridge, whereas the rest of the quotes in this episode are from the incredible Anne Carson's translation, which I cannot read entire speeches from. That edition, too, it's called An Oresteia, and it's wonderful because she uses one play from each tragedian, because we have this unique thing where this is the one story where all three tragedians have plays that survive that cover it. So in this edition, it has Aeschylus' Agamemnon, Sophocles' Electra, and then Euripides' Orestes. I highly recommend. It's a great translation. To remind you all where we left off, Orestes and Electra, the son and daughter of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, have murdered Clytemnestra in retribution for her murder of their father, Agamemnon. Though Orestes was the one who physically killed his mother, Electra was complicit in her own way, and so she holds her own grief and guilt along with him. Though ultimately both still feel as though they did the right thing in killing their mother, because they see their murder of their father as the worst of the crimes. Orestes, for his part in the physical act, has been hounded by the Furies, who they call the Eumenides, the kindly ones, because humans take great care not to use the name of the Furies, their true name, the Arenaways, instead using this euphemistic Eumenides. Ugh. But it's not just the Eumenides that Orestes has to deal with. The people of Argos are set to convene later that day and vote on whether or not to stone Orestes and Electra to death for what they've done. But for now, he and Electra are just waiting. Of course, they're not alone. Helen is there in Argos with the siblings, along with her daughter Hermione, who is living at the palace during the war under Clytemnestra's care. And Menelaus, too, has joined them at the city, though he's only spoken to Orestes so far. Menelaus is, as much as has been made clear up to this point, sympathetic of Orestes' plight. He certainly didn't mind seeing Clytemnestra killed for what she did to his brother. And finally, we ended last week's episode with the reveal that another important man was joining them on stage. Tyndareus, father of Helen and Clytemnestra, husband of Leda, and he's wearing black in mourning for his daughter. It's the chorus of Argive women who have pointed this out as he approaches, and at that approach, Orestes is ready to panic. This is episode 206, Setting the House Ablaze, Not Using Fire, Euripides' Orestes, Part 2. joins the stage and speaks to the chorus. He's asking them where Menelaus is, his son-in-law. He explains that he was just at his daughter's grave, pouring libations for Clytemnestra, when he heard that Menelaus and Helen had arrived there in Argos too. Of course, he doesn't need the chorus to show him Menelaus, as he's also there on stage, where Tyndareus seemingly hasn't noticed him. Same with Orestes, he hasn't yet seen him. Menelaus speaks first, showing himself to Tyndareus with a kind word of greeting, but before Tyndareus can say more than a quick hello to his son-in-law, he spots Orestes. Quote, "Here is the mother-killer snaking about in front of the house. Look at him, how he drips, unhealth, shudder object." Tyndareus seems to expect Menelaus to side with him, to see Orestes as this murderer deserving only of hatred, but Menelaus just says, quote, "He is the son of my beloved brother." There are so many family dynamics at play here. Two brothers married to two sisters where so much shit goes down. It makes this particular story of familial murder so much more interesting. Brothers, again, married sisters, marriage and in-laws don't change the relationships between siblings. And so Menelaus is more concerned with the death of Agamemnon than he is the death of Clytemnestra. And can anyone blame him? Tyndareus, though, can only see the horror in what Orestes has done. He questions whether Menelaus thinks that he's anything like his father, like Agamemnon, the great hero of the Trojan War. At least, I mean, that's how these men see Agamemnon. I, of course, have a different opinion. Menelaus says that Orestes is like his father, yes, just unfortunate. He confirms, though, that he has an obligation to his nephew. He doesn't say it outright, but the implication is there. Orestes might have killed Tyndareus' daughter, but he did it because Tyndareus' daughter killed Menelaus' brother. Tyndareus tells Menelaus bluntly, quote, "Your time in the East has barbarized you." To which Menelaus replies, quote, "It was always Greek to respect one's kin." Ugh, so much to unpack here. I know I explain this so often, but I never know who is coming to these episodes and what they do and do not know. So let me remind you all again. The word barbarian in ancient Greek just means that one is not Greek, but also it is still a very judgy. By spending so much time in Troy in the East, Tyndareus claims that Menelaus himself has become this barbarian. But like Menelaus says, the Greeks always had a specific way of dealing with those who murdered their family members, or rather the death of family members broadly. Menelaus is clear, he's more tied to his brother, and thus his brother's son, than his sister-in-law and her death. The two go back and forth when it comes to this. Tyndareus isn't letting up, and neither is Menelaus. They throw barbs, accuse each other of not respecting laws, of getting stupider in old age. Then Tyndareus launches into a speech explaining himself. This is the speech I read at the top. He rejects the idea that Menelaus suggested, that Orestes was acting smart in what he did. No, he says, smart would have been to punish Clytemnestra for what she did, which Tyndareus agrees was horrific and wrong, but that she should have been punished the right way, cast out, sent into exile, that murder shouldn't be met with more murder. Quote, "But as things are now, he's taken on board the same devils as she. He was right to think her evil, but this murder makes him more to blame." Then Tyndareus presents this situation to Menelaus for him to think about. What if one day Orestes, his wife, kills him, and then their son kills her, and then his son kills another in return? When will it end? How long will it continue? The question is both valid in terms of the law and what is right, but also it reminds the audience of the curse on Menelaus' own family. Like, Tantalus killed Pelops, and when Pelops was returned to life by the gods, he too killed another, and then his son Atreus killed Thyestes' children, and it kept going and going all the way down to Orestes, now having killed his mother, who killed his father, who killed his sister. He's right. Where will it end? And for all Tyndareus just had some very valid points about right and wrong and murder and retribution, revenge and everything that it contains, he then says, quote, "Now me, I despise impure women. In the first place, my daughter who slew her husband, and this Helen of yours, I won't even mention. You launched 1,000 ships for that?" Yes, those were all things that I read in the whole speech at the top, but these are in Carson's translations and they are better. So, you know, don't go thinking Tyndareus is just a man who loved his daughters and wants to defend that. He seems more interested in the crime that Orestes committed than the actual murder of his daughter. He does, however, turn to Orestes now and asks him very specifically how could he do it? How he felt when Clytemnestra begged him to spare her life, begged for mercy. Quote, "At any rate, it's obvious the gods hate you. You're paying off your mother's blood in bouts of lunacy." He finishes his speech by telling Menelaus very clearly, "Don't go against the gods. Don't go against the divine laws. Don't help your nephew after what he has done. Let Argos do what they're going to do. Let them kill him for the murder." His last lines are, quote, "I'm a fortunate man in other ways, but not in daughters. There I struck out." Oh, Tyndareus. Orestes is ready to defend himself against Tyndareus's words. He won't pretend that what he did to his mother wasn't bad, wasn't wrong, but he also won't pretend as though he didn't have good reason to do it. Honestly, normally I would be way more deferential to Clytemnestra, because she's a badass. Like, I absolutely understand why she felt she had to kill her husband, and frankly, I am basically always here for it. But this play is too interesting to spend our time defending Clytemnestra. What's done is done, and looking at Orestes as a character, his motivations, and what's going on in his head, in addition to everything Electra ever says, is far more interesting. Regardless of the fact that both of them just do not understand their mother and like are far too invested in their horrible father. Whatever. So Orestes defends himself, or he tries to. He admits that there's probably nothing he can say to Tyndareus to make the man understand him. And that's fine, but he's going to say his piece anyway. He says, quote, "I am unholy, a mother killer, at the same time pious and lawful, a father avenger. It's a contradiction. What should I have done?" He gets it. He killed his mother. That was wrong. But she killed his father, and that too was wrong. He goes on to defend himself more by explaining that Clytemnestra had taken a lover while her husband was away. His own cousin and enemy, Aegisthus. Orestes admits that he killed him too. It was all for justice. And then he defends himself against the potential stoning of him to death by the people of Argos, saying that actually, he's helped Greece with what he's done. Because, quote, "Picture this. Wanton women throughout the land, murdering husbands, running to sons for refuge, hunting pity with bared breasts. They'd be killing their men at the slightest pretext." Oh, Orestes, what an absolutely wild fucking thing to theorize. Anne Carson makes an amazing point about this play in that it seems like there are not meant to be like any sympathetic characters. Everyone says things that we can understand, empathize with, appreciate, and then they turn around and say and do a bunch of bullshit stuff. And isn't that the more interesting part? We aren't meant to side with any one person, to determine that anyone is more correct than anyone else. We're just meant to watch as this man and his family fall to fucking pieces. And I like that because I can both appreciate Orestes' character and also defend Clytemnestra and also talk about what an absolute batshit and typically male idea this is. That he actually did Greece a favor, because what? If he hadn't killed his mother for what she did, then all women across Greece would just feel like they can and should kill their husbands whenever they feel like it. Orestes, dude, get your shit together. Another interesting thing in all of this is that, at least up until this point, no one has really talked about the why of what Clytemnestra did. From past versions of this story, past plays, and sources, we know that Clytemnestra's primary reasoning for killing Agamemnon was that he had killed her daughter, Orestes' own sister, Iphigenia, sacrificed her before leaving for Troy. Now, in other versions of this, Orestes and Electra still hate their mother. They don't ever sympathize with her enough to actually understand why she did what she did. But at least that part is, like, mentioned and acknowledged. Whereas here, Orestes goes on to explain that actually he sees Clytemnestra as having killed Agamemnon simply because she had taken Aegisthus as her lover while Agamemnon was off defending Greece in war and didn't want her husband to punish her when he returned home. Like, he really makes her the villain in a very real and kind of new way. He even goes so far as to not only blame Tyndareus for even fathering Clytemnestra to begin with, but he compares her to, yes, you guessed it, Penelope. Because what so-called bad woman isn't compared to perfect and pious Penelope? Orestes says, quote, "Look, Telemachus didn't have to kill his mother. Why? Because she wasn't piling husband on top of husband." What a fucking sentence. This whole play is making me cackle with every wild statement. Husband on top of husband. Still, Orestes keeps going, finishing off his speech by saying, "Anyway, ultimately it was Apollo who made me do it in the first place. He should be able to call upon Apollo to clear him of this charge." His last line is, quote, "No, don't say my deed was evil. Unlucky, sad, disastrous, yes, not evil." To which the chorus of Argive women very ironically reply, quote, "Women always complicate things, don't they?" And then Tyndareus decides that not only will he now make it his mission to convince the people of Argos to punish Orestes with death, but that he will do the same for Electra. And to pile on to this talk of women complicating everything, he adds that he believes that she, Electra, is even more guilty than Orestes, that she deserves death even more than him, that it was her who turned him against their mother in the first place, telling him horrible things about Clytemnestra and Aegisthus. Quote, "It was Electra set the house ablaze, not using fire." It's always the woman's fault, isn't it? Now, I think a lot of people might read a play like this, particularly if they've not read a lot of Euripides, and see all of this and as an actual indictment against women, that it's a play that might confirm the nonsense spewed, say, in like the Thesmophoriadzusai, that Euripides hated women and wanted to make them look bad, always. Instead, I read this and I see the very obvious irony that's implicit in like every line. It's the most obvious in the chorus of women amidst a time when Euripides only ever had choruses of women saying that women complicate things. Or the way that Electra is suddenly, seemingly out of nowhere, like more to blame than Orestes. It feels like commentary, irony more than anything like actually against women as people. Tyndareus finishes by telling Menelaus again not to help Orestes and to stay out of Sparta if he's going to take on criminals as friends. And with that, he leaves. And we all just kind of forget the fact that Menelaus is meant to be the king of Sparta. I mean, Tyndareus used to be, but I think we're still to believe that like Menelaus is currently the king. It's interesting, but ultimately not the point. Tyndareus is gone, leaving Menelaus and Orestes on stage alone with the chorus once more.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With his grandfather, Tyndareus, gone, Orestes returns his attention to his uncle, Menelaus. Menelaus, though, needs a minute to think through everything that's happened. And once again, we get this kind of like odd interjection of comedy into this otherwise tragic play, as though Euripides is playing with the audience completely, playing with the irony inherent in a story like this, having comedy elements that are essentially just kind of like goofy. Menelaus asks Orestes to give him a minute to speak, that sometimes silence is better than speaking, and sometimes speaking is better than silence. To which Orestes just says, yes, and sometimes a long-ass speech is the best option. And then he launches into exactly that. And he starts it by telling Menelaus that he's not asking for a gift in his request for his uncle to save him, but what he's owed for Agamemnon's acts on behalf of Menelaus. So strong start, like just, you owe me one, man, for what my dad did. He goes on to explain, quote, just as my father undertook to do wrong, to make war on Troy, not for his own sake, but to put right the offense to your wife, so you must give back a wrong for a wrong. Orestes is lucky his father did something so utterly absurd for his brother, or he'd be well and truly fucked right about now. And Orestes really just keeps pushing it and ensuring that he makes clear that from where he's standing, he's asking for the bare minimum from Menelaus after what Agamemnon sacrificed. He points out that he's only asking for one day from Menelaus, whereas Agamemnon gave him 10 years. Oh, and he finally brings up the death of his sister, Iphigenia, except that it's in reference to yet another sacrifice that Agamemnon made on behalf of his brother. Nothing about her or Clytemnestra's feelings towards that murder. Just, well, he had to kill his daughter to get you to Troy, and I'm not asking you to murder Hermione for me. So really, again, I'm doing you a favor. He goes on. He asks Menelaus to think about what Agamemnon would say, what he would think if he were there watching now. He knows it's impossible. He says, but when things are impossible is when people really need friends. And then he's done. Quote, okay, there you have it. I've made my claim. I want survival. Who doesn't? But of course, the next person to speak isn't Menelaus, but the chorus, again, with this odd use of women. Quote, I'm only a woman, but I beg you to help those in need. You have the power. I am just so curious what Euripides is doing here, but I have all the confidence that he is doing it intentionally. Like, he knows the strength of women. Electra is a strong character, let alone everyone else he's written. And he's really playing with things here, playing with the role of women in this world, like infusing every line about them with sarcasm or irony. And like, he hasn't even used the chorus that much except to just kind of infuse these like weird women-based statements. Menelaus, though, doesn't tell Orestes what he wants to hear. He tells his nephew that he wants to be clear. He does respect him, even what he did to an extent. He wants to share his pain, their family, and family also helps fight enemies. But, he adds, that's only possible when one has the means. And after all the horrors of the Trojan War, he does not have the means. He is confident that the armies of Argos would best him if he went to war on behalf of Orestes. So he can't promise that. Instead, he suggests Orestes negotiate with the people. It may be diplomacy is the best bet, and perhaps he could even walk away from this alive. Like, maybe the mob of Argives could find it in their hearts to show compassion to Orestes, to spare his life. Instead, he says he'll help by trying to convince Tyndareus and the Argives to be wise in their decision. He tries to be reassuring in whatever way he can. He tells the truth. This is their only and best option. And with that, he leaves Orestes on the stage with just the chorus. And Orestes does not take this well. It's as though he hears something completely different from Menelaus, some kind of like outright betrayal, rather than an honest assessment of what is physically possible. It's another reminder that while Orestes may have seemed to be lucid since Menelaus joined him on the stage, he is still fighting his demons, literally, as the Eumenides, the Furies, just hound him internally. His first words are to call Menelaus a worm, to rage that his uncle was willing to go to war for a woman, Helen, but not for his nephew. And I mean, he's not technically wrong there, but it seems like Menelaus was pretty upfront about why he can't help through force. It's not that he doesn't want to, it's that they'd all die. He calls out to his own father, Agamemnon, announcing that he's friendless, betrayed, that they have no hope, all is lost. Before the very next line is, quote, oh, but look, here comes Pylades, my dearest friend. A sight as sweet as calm water to sailors. Not so friendless after all, are you, Orestes? Once again, he's done a complete about-face, reminding the audience that all is not well in Orestes' mind. He is scattered, broken, fighting at every turn. And we meet Pylades. So we meet Pylades, Orestes' dearest friend, and a figure that is, frankly, not unlike Patroclus to Orestes' Achilles. It's not as obvious, and the same argument for them being romantic can't necessarily be made, but they are very, very close. Pylades' first lines include, quote, how are you faring, dearest, sweetest, best of friends? You know you are all these to me. He tells Orestes that he's heard the news, that he and Electra are, almost certainly, set to be killed later that very day by the people of Argos. And, well, if Orestes is lost, Pylades is too, he explains. And I again say, Achilles and Patroclus vibes. The pair have a round of back and forth lines, a stichomythia, as I always want to tell you because it's the best word and describes this kind of like quick exchange of words between characters. They talk of Menelaus, how he's in town, but he isn't willing to help Orestes. They speak of his wife, Helen, and Orestes even says, quote, "Oh, I think she runs the ship." To which Pylades asks, quote, "Where is she, that weapon of mass destruction?" And I say again, I do love Anne Carson's translations. And I am fascinated by the references to women in this play. The near obvious tongue-in-cheek nature, particularly when it comes to this character, and when one imagines that Euripides staged his very sympathetic and very pro-woman play, The Helen, just 4 years before this play. The pair continue to explain what's happened, with Orestes telling Pylades what he asked of Menelaus, his uncle's answer, explaining where everyone is right now, how Tyndareus is there too, and oh, do they keep talking shit about Menelaus? Orestes is pissed. Then it's on to the vote, explaining that the citizens of Argos are set to vote on his and Electra's death very soon, maybe even now. When this prompts Pylades to suggest that maybe they run, Orestes notes that it is impossible. They're surrounded with guards stationed at every road. Quote, "Our house is beset like a town under siege." Pylades now takes to telling Orestes what's happened with him. And, well, much like the deal with Orestes, it's not good. Pylades, you see, helped Orestes with the murder of Clytemnestra, and he's going to pay the price, too. He tells his friend that his father has forced him out of his home, and while that's not been easy, he says, quote, "But I'm no Menelaus. I can bear this." Which, I mean, low blow to Menelaus, but I love it. Pylades goes on to explain that he's not afraid of the Argive people. They're not his people. The two debate the notion of mobs generally, whether they can be reasoned with at all. They're trying to figure out what to do, but in doing so, they're providing a commentary on, like, mob justice and justice broadly. Remember, for all the Greek tragedies are typically about stories from ancient Greek myth, they're also usually telling us something about Athens at the time. In this case, this is the last play that Euripides put on in Athens before he basically went into voluntary exile in Macedonia, giving up his homeland in favor of a power that was slowly growing and would eventually take over the Greek world. This is before Alexander, mind you, and Philip probably, but not too long. That Euripides did that, left everything he knew, his career, which was flourishing, he left everything for a place very far to the north, and that this was his last play? It is saying something, even if, frankly, we don't entirely know what. But for all this is absolutely speaking to Athens as a city at this time, these two friends are also just determining their own fates in whatever way. They discuss the possibility of speaking with the Council of Argives and attempting to plead their case. And for all I'm trying to succinctly explain this bit, their conversation is done in a fascinating way, so we're going to look at it like a little bit closer. Again, this is a stichomythia, so it's that quick back and forth of sentences. But there comes a point where Orestes and Pylades are finishing each other's sentences, which I'm going to try to convey here. Quote, "Start with me going to the Argive assembly to tell them that your actions were just in avenging my father, and although they are eager to seize you, I won't cower in silence and die." That was obviously each of their lines. It's hard. I'm not going to spell it all out. Anyway, it's not only a brilliant way of conveying what both men are thinking, but it really reminds the audience of their relationship. They are very close. Maybe in some kind of romantic relationship, though. Again, it's very safe to say either way that they could be just very good friends, but they would do anything for each other. And they know exactly how the other will behave. But they're not convinced this would work. Like, maybe it would be better to run, they theorize. But again, they were talking about how impossible that was. It would be difficult, but if they managed it, it would be safer than staying in Argos. And the question now is whether or not he will tell Electra before he leaves, to which Pylades says he shouldn't. Orestes says that she would cry if he did, and Pylades thinks that that is a bad omen. So once again, we get this really interesting thoughts on women. But they don't dwell for long on what Electra would say, and if she should be told at all. Instead, Orestes returns to considering what started the entire play. Those Eumenides that have been hounding him within his own mind. Quote, One last worry, Orestes says. And when Pylades asks what he's referring to, he says, quote, the ghastly goddesses. They'll send my wits astray. Ugh. Pylades offers to take care of Orestes, though. And when Orestes tells him that it would be rotten to care for him, Pylades replies, quote, not to me, not if it's you. And again, I say Achilles and Patroclus vibes. And even if they weren't lovers, I am fascinated and full of joy by their friendship. It's lovely. All the mother killing aside. Orestes, though, is more worried for what it might do to his friend to care for him in his madness. He's worried it might even like rub off on Pylades in some way. But Pylades is certain he's going to be there for Orestes. He's going to care for him. That like that's the type of friends that they are. With things seemingly decided, it seems like Orestes' plan is to run and Pylades will go with him. But he now wants to visit his father's tomb in a last-ditch effort to pray to Agamemnon to save his son. So Pylades says he will bring him there. He will help him. For all Orestes has been speaking, at least mostly clearly and lucidly, he still is not well. Those Eumenides are there. They're keeping a close eye on him, ready to spring at any moment, driving him back into his own mind and the horrors that exist within it. Orestes and Pylades leave the stage to the chorus, who sing of the house of Atreus, that cursed, cursed house of Atreus. Quote, because in ancient days from ancient ways came strife and hideous feasting, slaughter of children, blood for blood endlessly being paid back. They continue to sing of the acts of this family, of the mistakes, the beliefs in righteousness, even when there's murder involved, of Orestes killing his mother, even as she cried out to him, as she screamed, quote, child, your act is unholy. Don't make yourself infamous just to gratify your father. They sing of the blood on Orestes' hands, the furies hounding him for what he's done, the madness that consumes him. Quote, you wretch, your mother bared her breast. You sank your sword in it. And then Electra joins once more. The chorus tells her what's happened, that Orestes and Pylades have gone to the Council of Argives. But before they can say more, a messenger arrives with news. And oh, how we love a messenger here with news! Remember, the action rarely, if ever, happens on stage in Greek tragedy. That is where the messengers usually come in. And this time is no different. Messenger tells Electra, quote, the Argives voted death for you and your brother. Electra cries out, distraught, but she pulls herself together enough to ask for details, to ask how she and her brother are set to die. The messenger explains how he learned this news in the first place. He just happened to be there, actually. He'd come to speak with Agamemnon, who always gave him charity when he needed it, and instead he came upon this assembly of Argives set to vote. The assembly who had just noticed Orestes joining them, that he'd shown up for his own trial, which then began. An old friend of Agamemnon started it. He spoke of Agamemnon's glory, but little of Orestes' guilt or innocence, instead preferring to prioritize the glory of Agamemnon in this attempt to detract from what Orestes has done. But it was clear that he was beholden to others in the room who weren't necessarily on the same side. So then Diomedes spoke, the messenger tells Electra. Diomedes was in the war with Agamemnon, a warrior, and he supported exiling Orestes rather than death. Some agreed with Diomedes, the messenger goes on. Others did not. Another man rose up to speak. He spoke in favor of your death by stoning. At that, your grandfather Tyndareus spoke up in agreement. He voted that you and your brother be stoned to death. It continued like this, some speaking in favor and some speaking against, some even suggesting that they should crown Orestes as king for how he avenged the death of Agamemnon, how he killed the godless Clytemnestra for her crimes. This man worried that women would behave in similar ways with their husbands off at war if they did not condone the death of Clytemnestra. And then Orestes himself spoke up in his own defense. He speaks similarly to that earlier man, explaining that he was fighting for all of them in the same way that Agamemnon did when he killed his mother, because truly, how women would take advantage of their situation if Clytemnestra was not seen as the criminal. Quote, if murder of husbands is granted to women who will escape death, should we be their slaves? It's all upside down. She was the criminal. Gods, it's fascinating. These obviously ridiculous arguments. I almost think of this play like as a reaction to Aristophanes' Thesmophoria Zusai. Like, Euripides saw that nonsense that Aristophanes spewed, which was only like 3 years before this, about him giving up women's dark secrets, about all the horrible things they secretly did or wanted to do. And it's like, he saw that play about him and thought, well, maybe I'll give them all that play. A play where the fear is that women will do the unthinkable if they're even given the chance. That or he was writing some kind of commentary on the lives of women broadly, like this idea that they saw their own lives as so bad that they were all of them, always willing to kill their husbands and were just merely waiting for the opportunity. Whatever he's doing here, I am just obsessed with how weird and interesting and, like, obviously absurd it all is. But the messenger isn't done. Orestes, he says, persuaded some with these arguments, but not all. In the end, the vote was for death, though not stoning. That much Orestes was able to convince them of. Their deaths would come at their own hands, rather than the Argives. And with that, the messenger tells Electra that Pylades is bringing Orestes to her now. Quote, they're both in tears, you'll see, bitter spectacle. So get your sword ready, or rope, however you wish to die. Your noble birth has been no help to you, not to say Apollo on his famous oracle seat. That title was a quote from Anne Carson's translation. Oh, nerds, nerds, nerds. I fucking love this play, and gods, I love Euripides. This play is so interesting because it normally, like, really wouldn't be one of my favorites. Like, while I love this cursed family, I prefer Euripides' plays to be about, you know, women directly. But, like, it's this, these odd, ironic jabs against women here. It's Orestes' wild mind and behavior. Like, it's Electra broadly, it's the way that so few, if any, of the characters in this play are actually likable or redeeming in any way. He was playing with so many things here, and I love him for it. This has been so much fun to read and write about. I cannot wait to finish it off next week with, well, an enormous bang. Deus Ex Machina and all that. And, well, this episode is long enough, and I am really trying to make sure that this play doesn't run to 4 episodes, so with that, here's a very brief and lovely 5-star review from one of you amazing listeners. This one is from a user called Dvaramu from the States. Amazing! The best mythology show! I love the feminist approach. Thank you for helping bring forth women of antiquity. Thank you! I love that I'm doing that. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert, Michaela Smith, the Hermes to my Olympians, gods, Michaela does everything. She's just the absolute best. Couldn't do it without her. Same with Stephanie Foley, who works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Thank you all. My job is so fucking cool. How is this real? I am Liv, and I love this shit, like, so fucking much. Euripides.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.